My next guest is Sean Jacobs, whom I last spoke to last year. I caught up with him on his latest analysis of PNG and writing on various topics, especially on Papua New Guinea's democracy, approaching 50 years of PNG's independence from Australia back in 1975. Here is our conversation as I ask what he has been up to with family-wise first, before dwelling on Papua New Guinea's write-up in the Griffith Asia Institute journals. Welcome to Hereva Talk Talk, Sean.
Thank you, Maureen. Great to be back here. It's been a little while, I think.
I was going to say the last time I caught up with you is when you were intending to get married, and since then I hear you've got a baby and
everything. Wow. That's okay. that's a while. So
how's
a couple of years.
How's fatherhood going?
Really good, really good. I've got a beautiful young daughter. She's 7 months now, and she's yet to go up to New Guinea, but hopefully Ellie and I can take her up there sometime soon.
Has Ellie been to Papua New Guinea?
No, she hasn't. So this would be a trip for both of them, whenever that may be, but looking forward to introducing them both at some stage.
So is Bab sleeping well, or you?
Yes, touch wood. She's sleeping pretty well, and we're just trying to do the routine and get all those things sorted. But
that's
good. Touch wood.
Yeah,
Maureen.
That's good. Congratulations.
Thank you.
What have you been doing, and who are you with now?
Sure. No, so look, probably last time we spoke. So since we last spoke, the major development for me as it relates to New Guinea, I've really been actively involved with Griffith and become a Griffith Asia Institute Industry Fellow there. And you've probably seen, Maureen, I've really stepped up a lot of the writing on New Guinea and the analysis and for Griffith Asia Institute, and especially approaching 50 years, as people would be aware, for next year. It's a big year for New Guinea, and doing a lot of analysis around the state of its democracy, how its infrastructure is looking, the challenges like we were discussing before around water, electricity, all those major things that a lot of the country suffers from approaching its 50th year, but also how it can hopefully be optimistic as well. So you've probably been reading a few things of mine, I guess, lately. That's why we're here. But just all those things, I think approaching 50 years has really intensified my focus on New Guinea and the region, but really stepping it up in terms of focusing on Papua New Guinea and those challenges, like I mentioned.
So what have you really covered, or what have you written? What have you said in it?
Sure. So I've tried to be a bit creative, especially in the last few pieces, around really fundamentally looking at PNG's democracy. So I think when we last spoke on the, well, when you and I just spoke on the phone a couple of weeks ago, I'd put out a piece on Alexis de Tocqueville and his 19th century work, Democracy in America. And this was just a hypothetical, but I wondered, what would Tocqueville look at when he wandered through New Guinea and the state of its democracy? This is a famous book. He was very enlivened by what he saw in the United States and the state of its institutions, its people. And I was like, okay, well, what would happen if Tocqueville walked through Papua New Guinea in 2024, and what would he think? So I've tried to be sort of creative there. Another recent piece was just around what the Federalist Papers and what the Federalists would look at, John Jay, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison, the three authors of the Federalist Papers, how they would look at New Guinea's democracy. And I've tried to, be a bit optimistic, but also be quite straight and upfront about some of the challenges that New Guinea has approaching 50.
A lot of people would say the level of corruption has increased, or how would you see that?
Yeah, look, I think there's obviously so many things swirling around there. I try to write a piece on this when, the IMF, some listeners will be aware, is back in New Guinea. I think it had been probably close to 20 years since it was last there, or 15. I can't recall exactly when it was, Maureen, but I wrote a piece breaking down what are the three big challenges in New Guinea from a policy perspective that the government needs to fix, but corruption, other issues are getting in the way. And one of those is around electricity infrastructure. And I think, with Kumul Consolidated Holdings, for example, there's not really the expectation on the return there. Like if you had a privatised electricity grid, I'm not saying it needs to go to full privatisation, but when you have private investors that aren't the government, there's an expectation upon return. So that tends to iron out a lot of issues around corruption, etc. Just aren't there when you've got, again, an investor situation where they expect return. So I think that's probably one major thing where, you know, I can tag to whether it's corruption or whether it's monopolization. You know, people would probably say a similar thing. But, you know, there's a lot of, you know, it's not just electricity. I think there are a lot of issues where I think some smart policy decisions by the PNG government could solve a lot of problems.
There is water problems as well.
Mm. Yes, that's right. I think, you know, water is one of these things where, you know, especially when you see, you know, it's not just villages, but it's also hospitals as well. I think you would have seen this, Maureen, but I can't quite recall. It might have been Gulf Province a couple of months ago where the hospital there is just completely no power, no water, no medicine at all. And the situation is absolutely dire. So no equipment, nothing at all. And water in particular is something that they just don't have access to. So a lot of the nurses who aren't paid are walking miles back and forth to get, you know, buckets of water. And then also just facing really horrific violence too from family members who come in. That's just one example of probably what's replicated across all the provinces and remote areas.
Talking of that, one of the remote areas, the school I went to, we are raising funds for a water project for women to give birth, after birth and all that. What do they need to wash themselves with or clean the aid posts?
Sure.
So it's on Yule Island. So that's what we're fundraising for, and our events are happening on the 30th. Anyway.
Good on you.
Yeah. Apart from that, you did also write something about the police, policing in PNG. Maybe we could touch on that as well. That's security is a major issue.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, probably a lot of people would have paid close attention to the violence in Enga over the past few months in particular, but you've had in the past fortnight this bus shooting, I think 7 dead, and indiscriminate violence, you know, where we're not used to seeing these sorts of instances of retribution, where we're just totally, and, you know, ECPIC, I think, you know, back in July were 16 women and children. There's a long, the Post Courier had a piece the other day where they just documented all of these instances of violence, and very horrific and very chilling. I think one of the things, Maureen, I've written about for a long time in New Guinea is just the sheer lack of police numbers. PNG has a police to civilian ratio of almost 1 to 2,000. So one police officer to almost 2,000 citizens. Now in Fiji, it's about 1 to 500. I think the Solomons is 1 to 500 or 550 or whatever it is. And the UN recommends, I think it's about that ratio. PNG's four times that. And as you know, it's very dispersed and rugged, so accessibility is really tricky. You know, I remember earlier this year, you know, when Enga was flaring up again, and also Hela province, I remember Prime Minister Marape saying that there was only two police officers in Como, in Hela. And the amount of violence that's going on there, went on there this year or in the past couple of years, has been chilling. So I've written a lot. Yeah, you're right, Maureen, about trying to boost the police numbers. And I think that's something that it's a tangible output. If you increase the number of police officers, you put them through the training colleges, you put them onto the streets, you get them uniform, you get them equipped. I'm not saying it's a simple fix, but the problem with the violence that we're seeing is just driven by a complete lack of the government, but a complete lack of police.
There are a lot of unemployed people still around. So you think one would try and invest in the recruitment of police?
Is it
lack of budget as well in the police service?
Yeah, I think there's probably, they lack a clear strategic focus. You know, I say these things like it's really easy to do, but, you know, I think you've got the issue of training, recruiting, training. There's no shortage, as you mentioned, Maureen, of willing candidates. I think every application round that the RPNGC has is oversubscribed substantially. So people are interested. There's probably just not the infrastructure there to actually train the volume, give them equipment, and actually put them onto the streets with land cruisers, with working vehicles, with communications, with firearms that work. There's all these things that spin off of this which make it a challenge, but you're right, there's a lot. It's very oversubscribed in terms of applications.
There were talks that PNG was trying to sign some security pact with China.
Oh, with China, okay, sure. So no, I believe that there's discussions, and that, you know, that things flared up. I remember speaking to the PNG Business Council on a forum there earlier this year when there was an acute attention or acute focus on that. And some of the things that were said, you know, strategically, there's still a lot of concern about the China-PNG relationship and how that discussion is maturing. I think this is something to come back to what we're talking about before, where there's a bit of, I think, you know, we can be a little bit optimistic with here about how things have gone, because I think PNG, the government has signed a host and refreshed and renewed a host of international security agreements with the United States, with Australia, with even France, with the UK, but it hasn't come at the expense of its really important economic relationship with China. So I think PNG collectively, but the government in particular, has been clear about its shared values, which I think is with the United States, with Australia, but then also shared interests, which still remains with commercial partners like China, and not crisscrossing those things over, but being a friend to all, enemy to none. And it's a bit of an interesting term, but I think that's been something that's been played quite well, because it does show where PNG is at the end of the day when it comes to its values collectively.
Sean Jacobs writes optimistically and hopes to continue to inform readers about what really is happening and has happened. I continue to ask him about his thoughts about sports diplomacy, especially for Papua New Guinea having to join the NRL in Australia. He also touches on climate change issues and customary land. Current governments of both Australia and PNG, now we're going to rugby league or sports for that matter, are trying to have NRL, have a PNG team in the NRL. What is your observation? What's the...
Yeah, sure. Look, I think it's hard to find anyone who thinks this is not a good idea. I think everyone's collectively for it, you know, certainly in New Guinea, but certainly I think in the sporting community in Australia, sports is a great forum for those shared values, as you know, and I think that goes across the Pacific. I hope that, you know, it's not an easy thing running a multi-million dollar operation, and especially one that's in the premier rugby league forum on the planet. So I think things are going to be very quite challenged in terms of keeping the talent coming through with the players, for example, performing at that top tier and having the depth. I think there's that there, but that will be increasingly challenged and sustained. But then also on the financial, the operational side of things as well, just how hard it is to actually run these enterprises. And I wish it every success. I hope it goes well. But I think as a point of diplomacy or shared values, it's a great concept, great idea, and I hope things go well.
Just looking at Facebook pages, some were saying maybe the money should be invested in health and water and electricity.
Okay, interesting.
Services,
yeah.
From the local people. One of the interviews I had with a lady going to Milne Bay is saying she's investing in bringing soccer balls and basketballs instead of rugby league balls to the...
Sure.
Yeah, so yes. That's interesting.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, so what are the topics, what are the articles are you writing at?
Yeah,
sure. To
look, thanks, Ryan. I'm thinking, you know, coming up with 50 years next year, I'm sort of going to continue a lot of the analysis on New Guinea. I think, you know, trying to put together all the things I've written on New Guinea over the past 12, 13 years in particular. You know, I think something around climate change, and, you know, you would have seen the PNG foreign minister yesterday announced that they weren't attending COP29.
As I was going to ask you what your thoughts were on that.
Protest. Look, this is an interesting one, I think, Maureen. I don't know if the motivations for not going are, you know, I think there's probably alternative motivations for not attending. You might remember for COP26 in Glasgow, there was a lot of domestic pushback for the size and scale of the PNG delegation. 6 million kina, I think, was spent on sending, you know, scores of government officials, and there was a lot of criticism. And I think 6 million kina is probably a conservative estimate, given how expensive travel and accommodation is to these forums. But look, I think the foreign minister is probably motivated by that versus what he said around, you know, the domestic pushback for not attending versus attending. I think that's probably driven that decision more so than what's been led on.
Papua New Guinea's decision to pull out of climate change COP has drawn a bit of criticism from the local climate change warriors in Papua New Guinea. What is your opinion on that?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, Maureen. I think the motivations around the decision probably might be a bit more nuanced than what's been led on by the foreign minister. I think there's probably a lot of domestic pushback around not attending. You might recall COP26 in Glasgow, where the PNG government sent a sizable delegation. You know, I can't remember exactly how many government officials, but in the cost or in the order of 6 million kina to Glasgow. And there's a lot of domestic, I guess, criticism of that decision. So I think that's probably motivated largely the decision to not attend this time versus what's been said publicly by the foreign minister around a lack of outcomes on the front end of the effects of climate change.
One would have thought, like, being a leader in terms of population-wise and resource and in the Pacific, maybe other people will disagree, other Pacific Islanders will disagree, but wouldn't it have been a good opportunity for Papua New Guinea to be seen in this international domain?
I'm sort of half in, half out with these, to be really honest with you, Maureen, about how productive some of these international fora are. And I've, you know, written about this quite extensively too. But overall, you want to be in the room, and I think you want to be part of the discussion. Otherwise, if you're not, then you can't participate in the decision making. And then, you know, politically, you can be accused as well by other countries of pulling out and not participating and not shaping the agenda. So broadly, I think they need to be there, but I think it really needs to be a sobering look at how many people you need and how much money's spent in attending these forums.
So who actually pays for all these travels and that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, when I was with the UN, there's a lot of subsidised travel that comes through the United Nations, and that would be the case with this. But there's certainly, you know, I think the majority of a cost like this would come out of the PNG government budget. But there is some subsidy available from the UN.
So are there any other important articles that you've written that we need to talk about?
Look, I'd like to say yes, but I think those are probably the main ones, Maureen. You know, I think, you know, like I mentioned before, I think, you know, there's a lot of policy challenges that I think can be solved very rapidly in New Guinea. You know, that you look, you know, for example, and I touched on the electrification issues in New Guinea. In the early 2000s, you know, it was about 10% of the population had access to electricity. Today, it's around 13%. So, you know, in 20 years, there's 3% more people, you know, out of a nation of approximately 11 million people have access to electricity. There's dire energy poverty. I probably want to try and focus a bit more of my effort bringing that to light a bit more and what can be properly done. The electrification partnership goal is 70%. By 2030. That's, you know, only 6 years away, and it's got to go up by 60%, which I think, you know, a lot of experts, you know, look at this, it's just simply not achievable. It was a grand ambition and a grand goal, but I think we need to really shine a light on that and, you know, the energy poverty in New Guinea. So I think that's going to be a key focus of mine. And then also the long lines for petroleum and fuel and just how crippling that is for, and it's driven by a foreign exchange shortage, which is a crisis. But, you know, when people are queuing for hours on end to get fuel, it's not a good thing for anyone. You know, when it comes to commerce, yes, but for, you know, all the things that we mentioned before, you know, it's outboard motors, people getting from the villages into hospitals in regional townships. You need petroleum for that. You need petroleum to get the PMVs moving around, you know, Leh, Kavieng, you know, up and down the Bulyminsky. Mm. If you don't have petroleum, it's the same with electricity. You really cripple the circumstances of people, everyday people in New Guinea. And I think those two things in particular, energy poverty and lack of access to petroleum, all those issues around foreign exchange, are really something I think we need to focus on coming into 50 years.
So 50 years on for next year, do you think Papua New Guinea is poor?
In terms of where?
Grassroots, I guess you'll have to. Yeah, grassroots basically, even though they own 90% or 95% of the land.
Oh, sure. Yeah, look, I, you know, there's, it's, land ownership is critically important, but if you need to have a system or rule of law that honours what people actually own. And when you have a very complicated customary land process, a lands department that's not terribly responsive or administratively efficient, to be brutally honest. I'm sorry for my friends that work there. But when you've got a really, I guess, brittle rule of law regime when it comes to the land, you know, proving on paper what you own so you can get capital, so you can raise funds to build a commercial enterprise, then yes, there's poverty there because it can't be converted. They have this problem all over the world of a lot of people who are very poor but have assets and can't prove it on paper that they own it. And I think, you know, if there was a way to improve that in New Guinea, that would substantially improve things. But yeah, look, in 50 years, I think things have changed and brutally not for the better. Some things have gotten better, of course, but I think a lot of people would look back at 1975 and look at where things are today and be hard to find being optimistic about New Guinea, sadly.
So I'm speaking to Sean Jacobs, who's the industry fellow at Griffith Asia Institute. So you do write a lot of analysis and reports and
yes,
all that sort yep. of stuff. Yeah. Absolutely. So how long have you been doing this now?
Oh, gosh. I think Tess Newton Kane signed me up, brought me on board. Thank you, Tess. It's probably 6 months to a okay. year now. Oh, it's a pretty good. Recent, but yeah.
This is Herbert Talk Talk, a Papua New Guinea content program of Radio 4EB on 98.1 FM. Sean Jacob also speaks on the role of women being great contributors to PNG's lifeblood of Papua New Guinea's economy with the heavy presence of women as market vendors. Sean Jacob speaks on the representation of women in politics as well. So how would you have seen the role of women in all forms of areas over the 50 years?
Yeah, very interesting question and something I used to work in really closely. Maureen, you might recall I started my career in New Guinea with the UN, UNIFEM, and which is now the UN, now UN Women, got absorbed into that. But look, I think that there's probably two things here. One, you look at the PNG economy at the grassroots level, and it's really driven in every town by women market vendors, right? They're 95 to probably 98% of the market vendors in marketplaces, in regional centres. And that is the lifeblood of the PNG economy. You know, I'm pretty sure, and I don't know if this is still true, but it would probably be the case. When we did some economic analysis in Port Moresby, Gordon's Market would turn over more in a day in terms of Kina than the yacht club in a year, which is amazing. I don't know if that's still true, but that was when we did a bit of economic analysis. So that just reveals the contribution of women in a raw commercial sense to Papua New Guinea. And you can think about all the, you know, Goroka, Kundiawa, Lae, all the, you know, Cape, all the markets and just the amount of commerce that's taking place and women are heavily involved in that. I think people focus on the politics as well about female representation or women in politics in New Guinea. Pretty dire picture at the moment and has been, since 1975. Only a handful have served in the PNG parliament. And that looked to be changing last term or the term before. But things have sort of gone back to square one in terms of political representation. You might recall there was the Reserve Seats for Women campaign.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, a little while back. And that's, you know, the steam's come out of that a little bit. But, you know, but I think it's really, so there's two things, like I mentioned. It's the commerce and women market vendors that are keeping the economy moving at a grassroots level. And then secondly, you know, the political representation hasn't quite been there since 1975. So the two things at very different ends. But one example of, you know, two very different examples, I suppose, Maureen.
Thank you very much for that. Is there anything else you want to add?
If anyone's interested in reading any of my stuff, at Griffith Asia Institute, as Maureen mentioned, and on the blog there's so much good analysis by a lot of fellow industry fellows, but others as well, and a lot of my stuff there too, which I hope people find insightful.
So it's industry fellow with Griffith Asia Institute.
Correct.
So I've been speaking to Sean Jacobs, who's part Papua New Guinean, Kavieng to be precise, and Australian.
Mm-hmm.
And he has written extensively on as a industry fellow with Griffith Asia Institute. Thank you very much for your time.
And now, thank you, Maureen.